So we retrofitted a retreat to 20 years earlier. We had old men live there as if they were their younger selves. So everything suggested it was 20 years earlier, and they would be talking about the past, but in the present tense. And in a period of time as short as 1 week, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength improved, their memory improved, and they looked noticeably younger.
Welcome back, Leg Tuck Nation. It's been a while since we've done that one. Welcome back, Leg Tuck Nation. If you're new to the pod, welcome. Drew and Alex here for another week. We have outkicked our coverage as far as guests go. This week we are talking with Alex.
Yeah, we've cited her a couple times on the podcast before, most notably the Chambermaid study. This guest is a titan in the mindfulness space.
She's known as the mother of mindfulness, if that's any indication.
So Dr. Ellen Langer was the first woman to be tenured in psychology at Harvard, where she is still a professor of psychology today. She's the recipient of three Distinguished Scientist Awards, the Arthur W. Statz Award for Unifying Psychology, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the Liberty Science Genius Award. She is the author of 12 books, including international bestseller Mindfulness, as well as The Power of Mindful Learning, Counterclockwise, which you'll hear her mention in the episode a little bit, which is an incredible study on essentially reversing aging by changing the conditions people are in, and On Becoming an Artist. Her trailblazing experiments in social psychology have earned inclusion in the New York Times Magazine's Year in Ideas issue. And she, as we mentioned, is known worldwide as the mother of mindfulness. You really, at least in America and probably the world, can't find a more qualified expert to have a conversation about what mindfulness is and what it can do for you.
One of the reasons we reached out to her, and again, just like took a total moonshot here, but her most recent book is called The Mindful Body. And longtime listeners of this podcast will know that obviously human performance is one of the foundations of why we started doing this in the first place. And so to have somebody who is a leading expert in effectively tying all of that together through mindfulness, which is what that book talks about, was really unique. And as you can probably imagine from somebody who is in fact known as the mother of mindfulness, her perspective on this topic is all-encompassing. She is far more qualified than we are to discuss these things. You can find her having conversations with Jordan Peterson. You can find her giving TED Talks on all this type of stuff. So one of those episodes that hopefully will drive those of you listening into some kind of further reading and further thinking, because there is so much more to this topic than we could ever hope to cover in a single episode.
Yeah, we'll drop a bunch of links to studies in the show notes. It will not be a comprehensive list of studies because there's just too many. It's almost comical. Like, even other studies in the field, almost all of the authors were once students of Ellen's at some point, dominating the space. You'll hear the phrase mind-body unity a couple times in the episode. That's a key phrase you can go look for to find a lot of her work. It's definitely something we'll talk about. And I think it's worth noting before we roll into the actual episode here, you'll hear almost immediately that we did not come into the conversation necessarily agreeing on everything. She pushed back on us. We pushed back on her a little bit. I think there was some pretty engaging conversation here about the role mindfulness plays and whether it's universally applicable and all sorts of stuff like that. So it was, Ellen did not hold back on challenging us, certainly. I don't know if we challenged her as hard as she challenged us, but she definitely tried to change our perspective a little bit, and we hopefully provided a conversation that'll change yours too.
Enjoy. I do want to ask you kind of a dumb question, but I think it's an important one, which is what is mindfulness, yeah, aside from the buzzword piece?
Yes, no, that's a very important question, actually. You know, I've been doing this work since the early 70s and have contributed, I think, to the use of the word, although many people don't understand or don't know what I'm actually saying. Many people, when you think of mindfulness, they think of meditation, and meditation is fine, but it's not mindfulness. Meditation is a practice you engage in to result in post meditative mindfulness. Mindfulness, as we study it, couldn't be simpler. It's the simple process of noticing new things. And when you notice new things about the things you thought you knew, you come to see you didn't know it at all. And then your mind naturally goes to it. Now, all of this research over so many years has made clear to me that virtually all of us are mindless most of the time. We're not there. And the problem is when you're not there, you're not there to know you're not there. So I'm here to tell you that all of this work says that we're mindless, letting the past determine the present. You know, then you have some people, well-meaning people who say, stop and smell the roses or be in the moment. And, you know, that's very nice, but it's an ineffective instruction because, again, when you're not there, you don't know you're not there. So the way to be there are two ways, actually. One is if you can just accept that you don't know. Uncertainty is the rule, not the exception. Everything is always changing. Everything looks different from different perspectives. All right. So then if you know you don't know, you sit up and you pay attention, right? It's because you think you know. So be mindless is essentially frequently in error, but rarely in doubt. Now, when you're actively noticing things about the things you thought you knew, then you come to the same conclusion. Gee, there's more to this than I thought. So when I'm giving lectures, just to put everybody on the same page, I might say, and I'll ask you, Drew, how much is 1 + 1? Because this is the thing that everybody knows, right? All right. Mm-hmm. And so if you hadn't read the book, you'd probably say 2. But 1 and 1 is not, in fact, if you even read the book and then forgot it, you might say.
I know the answer is not 2 because I've asked this question before, so I'm keeping my mouth shut.
Okay. Well, 1 and 1 can equal mm-hmm. 2. It can also be quite different. If you're adding 1 pile of laundry + 1 pile of laundry, 1 + 1 = 1. Add 1 cloud + 1 cloud, 1 + 1 = 1. 1 wad of chewing gum + 1 wad of chewing gum, 1 + 1 = 1. So in the real world, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 1. It doesn't equal 2, as often as it may. Now, so now that I've just taught you that 1 + 1 might not be 2, and after we speak, somebody, this is not very likely, but hey, Drew, how much is 1 + 1? So rather than mindlessly answering 2, what you do is pay some attention to the context, and then you'd say it could be 2. Mm. All right. And so you can feel the difference, you know, that mm-hmm. when you live in a conditional world, a maybe world, you pay attention to see what things are important at this moment.
I want to ask, because I know like the types of people that listen to this, and specific to the military, like they want to get into the weeds and they want to have sort of really specific answers and instructions. And so when you say mindfulness is paying attention to things, on the one extreme, I think of like, okay, I'm looking outside right now. Like, am I constantly scanning leaves, trees, houses, cars?
No, that's a good question.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well, really, I think that what I probably should have said 45 years ago when I started with this is that we should never be mindless. We should never presume that we know. And so when you're walking outside and you're looking, you can pay attention to whatever it is you want to pay attention to, but just without the mindless certainty as you're crossing the street, so you're oblivious to the car that's speeding down the road. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there was a study that I did a while back that's relevant to the Army indirectly. What we did was have orchestras. So imagine, you know, teams, battalions, whatever, in the Army. We had orchestras perform the piece of music they were going to play with the instruction, this is the mindless group, remember a time that you played this where you were pleased with your performance and then just replicate it. For the mindful group, they were told, make it new in very subtle ways that only you would know. All right. And so to make it new, that means they have to be there, present. Mm-hmm. And we record the piece, both pieces, and we play it for people who know nothing about the study. And people overwhelmingly prefer the mindfully played piece. And the musicians overwhelmingly prefer playing mindfully. Now, it wasn't until I wrote this up that I realized how this speaks to leadership. All right. Now, if you recognize that the group that was mindful, that was actively noticing new things, that was in the present, came to superior coordinated experience, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so when you think, when you're worried about what if all the troops are mindful, thinking that, well, they're all going to be going in, you know, this way, that way. I don't think so. I think that what it would do was to bring everybody to the same place. Now, when you're mindless, you don't know what place it's bringing anybody to. All right. So that's kind of interesting, because I think that when battles and, you know, things of this are on one's mind, you want to make sure that people do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it would be wrong to think that if they were mindful, you can't control them. You would not, if people were mindful, be able to probably to get people to do things that people shouldn't do. All right. But if there's a goal to be accomplished, it's going to be accomplished best by people being mindful. When you're mindful, you get to notice opportunities to which other people are blind, and you avert the danger not yet arisen.
You were talking about like coordinating teams of people, and we've actually discussed that kind of thing numerous times on this podcast, not just in the classic military sense of squads and platoons and companies, mm-hmm. but we work in the human performance space, and there's a lot of research on interdisciplinary human performance, getting strength and conditioning professionals to collaborate with nutrition professionals and mental health professionals and things like that. I don't know if I have a question at the end of this, but there's clearly something to the idea of, if each member of the team is operating mindfully, I think that's going to lead you in the direction of better interdisciplinary performance when you're combining specialties.
Yeah, I think without question in my mind, because when people are mindful, there's always a modicum of uncertainty, you know, which in some sense can be translated as a little humility. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in one area and somebody else is in a different discipline and speaks up, there's no reason to feel threatened. You don't close yourself off to what's being said. In fact, what you do is now have many choices about how to incorporate that information into what you already know. So the main thing is that when you're mindless, you have no choices. You're not there, essentially. It's like sending a bunch of robots out. And if you were to send a bunch of robots out to do whatever it is you wanted, you can imagine how that could be terrible, because when you start, you're programming these robots to do one thing, but the circumstance may have changed and you want the person to be aware so that they can change with whatever that change is.
So I got to ask this question, because you're teeing it up, and I know I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but it's an important one, because, and we talked about this a little bit off air, but like the military is at a sort of a crossroads where they understand, I would argue, the human element that they're dealing with, and people are individuals and they can make choices. And, you know, we see that in little ways, like women can wear ponytails now, whereas before that was very much a taboo.
That's probably the biggest, most important change that's occurred.
but I think the point you're making is incredibly important about mindlessness, because the things that you're saying are that could be perceived as negative, you know, robots and just doing things without thinking. That's exactly the type of soldier that the military wants to create. And I mean, you can look back at literature from World War I and World War II and even present day, and it's like, as soon as the bullets start flying, I just revert to the level of my training and I could operate my weapon and engage with the enemy and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, you don't want that. What you want is for people to be present so they can take advantage of whatever is happening right at that moment, which may or may not be consistent with the original training. You know, a homey little example that is more relevant for older people. And I ask people, what do? You're driving a car and the car starts to skid. Mm-hmm. Now, what most older people will say, you gently pump the brake. And that was true in the past for safety's sake. But now that we have anti-lock brakes, the safe thing to do is to jam, you know, press on the brake very, very hard. Mm-hmm. So what in the past was unsafe now becomes safe, or the reverse of what I've just said. You know, you're doing something to be safe, and it with the change is unsafe. And so we never know what things are going to happen. You know, that I think to try to make people like robots in some sense relies on a mistaken belief in predictability. You know, because you have to program them to do something. And when you recognize that prediction is more or less an illusion, that then you want people to be there so that they can make whatever decisions are sensible at the moment. People don't realize that we can't predict because they're so good at post-dicting after the fact, as you would say, Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, so if I were to ask you, is my internet connection going to help us for, so we can have the rest of this interview? You have no idea, right? I have no idea. If everybody in the neighborhood started using their internet right at this moment, possibly not, you know, which could happen because there are so many terrible things happening in the world at the moment. A homier example, let's say you're at a party and you see Alex and Mary, you see Alex and Mary fighting. And I said to you, are they going to get divorced? You'd say, how do you know? Right? People fight. But now, as more typically the case, so we notice Alex and Mary fighting. 2 weeks later, somebody tells us, you know, Alex and Mary are getting a divorce. Ah, I knew it. You should have seen the way they, you know, went at each other at the party. So when you know you can't predict, then you stay present, right? You know, and that's all that all of this information is arguing for. There's so many other advantages, though, to this active noticing. It's the essence of engagement. It feels good. All right. Now, you know, if you have any organization, the organization is going to prosper from the members in that organization being happy, being healthy, and alert. And you can't have that when you're mindless. When you're mindless, you're not there, and you're not there to know you're not there.
This isn't something I had remotely expected to talk about on this podcast.
Well, there you go. That's what I said. You
can't. You've been fighting with Mary, Alex. Stop fighting with Mary.
We're getting close to the topic, though, because I think there is like a superficial idea of we want like robotic soldiers, and certain tasks do need to be trained that way. You need to know exactly how to respond when your weapon malfunctions and certain things like that.
No. Wait, Alex, I disagree respectfully, or maybe not respectfully, but I disagree that you anything you learn, you want to learn it with an understanding that it's more or less going to work in this fashion.
Sure.
Right. You know, and so if you're doing it like a robot, the little piece that wasn't manufactured to be up to code, you know, is going to be ignored rather than now you say, oh, I need to make this slight adjustment.
See, that's a good point.
Well, I think that fits in well because like the DOD's overall approach.
And would you have predicted that Drew would prefer my comments to yours?
I mean, well, hold on,
can predict.
I'm going to interrupt Alex and then let him take this back because I remember reading the book On Combat by Colonel Grossman. And he talks about when when law enforcement are training on the range, they noticed that when they were done firing, all of their spent rounds were in their hands. Or no, sorry, when they were engaging with criminals on the street, they noticed when they were done fighting, they had collected their spent rounds. The reason for that was because when they were on the range practicing, they were told, pick up your brass because we have to clean the range and blah, blah, blah. So I see what you're saying because you argue that you would want them to mindlessly be present or not present, but mindlessly engage with the enemy. But to that same point, be aware of the fact that things can malfunction. Things might be.
I don't think you never want to be mindless. This is something people really don't understand. So when you realize that being mindful is easy, that it's the essence of engagement, it's fun, and it's good for you. We make people more mindful, they live longer. So it feels good and it's easy and it leaves its imprint in what you're doing. Why would you ever want to be mindless? Now, but we have that so ingrained in us that somehow you learn it so well, but you don't have to think about it. And that's fine. unless one of two things happen. Well, it's good to be mindless if you found the very best way of doing something, and two, nothing changes. You know, and those conditions are never going to be.
Don't happen.
Otherwise, you should be there. So let's say somebody had once said to me, all right, you're at a park. You've got a little kid. The little kid wanders onto the street. Shouldn't you just mindlessly grab them, to make them safe? And my answer to that is simple. That first of all, if you were mindful, the child wouldn't have ended up in the street. And number two, that a car can go to the right, to the left, straight, you know, whatever. And so you don't want to just mindlessly grab the child. You want to have some, you want to notice where the car is going so that you can take the child out of harm's way. And the difference between being mindful and mindless, people think, well, being mindful takes a long time. It doesn't. Mindlessness may be nanoseconds faster. And I don't know a situation where that really matters. But not only that, what the Army and everybody else, any organization needs to realize is that mindfulness is energy begetting. And so what you want are the soldiers on the field, the workers, at work, whatever the location, you want them to be there and top of their performance, not exhausted, and you're more likely to get that if everyone is mindful. It's also the case that when you're talking about anything where there are several people involved, interpersonal relations matter. And I don't know if the Army has paid much attention to this, but this is something that, I've done so many experiments with people, living longer, really important kinds of findings. Nevertheless, this one realization was one of the most important things to me. Behavior makes sense from the actor's perspective, or else the actor wouldn't do it. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, today I'm going to be impulsive, obnoxious, and a bigot. All right. So when we see anybody doing anything and we cast aspersions and we judge them negatively, we're being mindless because there's an equally strong but oppositely balanced alternative. So, Drew, I can't stand you. You're so impulsive. That's because from your perspective, you're spontaneous. And Alex, you are so inconsistent. It's hard to ever know what you're going to say or do. That's because from your perspective, you're flexible. All right. And when we recognize that any of these negative judgments can also, if we were mindful, be seen as positive, imagine how differently we treat people. So if I see Alex is inconsistent, I'm going to belittle him. I'm going to not trust him. Lots of things will happen. When I see Alex as flexible, now I care about him. I respect his views. And I treat him differently. And my feeling is, in all seriousness, that if you're going out and as a group doing some dangerous mission, I can't imagine there aren't tens, hundreds of ways in which caring for the people around you wouldn't be important.
So I'm going to come back to that in a second, because that's exactly where we were going before this. But I do want to ask
that one. How I got there without making a prediction. Yeah.
So did you change
your mind as to where?
I'm absolutely changing my mind.
He's flexible. He's very flexible.
So your book highlighted that thesis, the concept that behavior makes sense from the actor's perspective rather than like traditional versions of rational actor model. But since I spend a lot of time thinking about like the psychology of health behaviors and lifestyle and exercise and things like that, how do we reconcile that concept with things like psychological inertia, where people know that a change would be good for them, but struggle to make that change?
Yeah, I don't think they really know the change. People say, I want to lose weight. I want to stop smoking. I want this or that. Let's say you want somebody to stop drinking as much as they drink. And the person says, I don't want to drink a lot. The person isn't, because let's say it's not argument's sake, but for real, drinking damages your liver. Nobody is drinking in order to damage your liver. So they're not going to stop drinking when you say it damages your liver. You have to know why they're engaging in the behavior. Now, if you said to anybody, a person can do, when a person is anxious, doing X relieves that anxiety, should they do X? And when put in the abstract like that, you'd say yes. Everybody's behavior makes sense. So then the question is to not put the person down for what they're doing, but instead to provide alternative means for them to get their needs met. In this case, reduce their anxiety.
I like that. I think that's actually extremely helpful when we talk about like coaching people on lifestyle behaviors. Bringing it back to the military a little bit, as you were talking, I pulled up Mission Command, which is how the U.S. military approaches, theoretically at least, approaches giving orders and leading large organizations and things like that. And it's not actually new, goes all the way back to the Prussians, but I'm just going to read from the Joint Chiefs of Staff page their definition, which is, mission command is the conduct of military operations through decentralized execution based on mission type orders. It exploits the human element, emphasizing trust, force of will, initiative, judgment, and creativity. And the idea there is that the U.S. military learned a long time ago that things don't go well when you tell people how to do something because you can't predict the scenario they're going to end up executing in.
Right.
We perform well when we have well-trained subordinate leaders who have a clear end state in mind, that we've explained to them what we want accomplished, but then we give them the latitude to figure out the how. And I think you've already articulated here why making sure those subordinate leaders are mindful and noticing things and understanding when the specific way they practiced might not be applicable sets people up for success, even in scenarios like combat, where we might think mindlessness could be relevant.
Yeah. What you just read suggested that the goal is etched in stone. And I think that too needs to be reconsidered. You want to see when people are mindless, goals, routines determine what you're going to do. When you're mindful, these goals, routines guide what you're going to do. Because sometimes something happens where you don't want to do what you had planned to do. You can't account for everything. And when you're telling people exactly what to do, then we're back to believing that you can predict what's going to happen. And all we know is that something's going to happen that was unpredictable.
I don't know if during the process of inviting you on here and explaining to you what we do, we explained what MOPS and MOES means.
No,
but I think
you might have, but I didn't pay any attention to it.
She was mindless.
I wasn't mindless. No, I was off doing something else. Your invitation sounded interesting, and so I said yes. I didn't have to read more about it and get on to other things.
So that's on us, and I think it's useful to explain what it means right now because it's surprisingly relevant. So it stands for measures of performance and measures of effectiveness. Measures of performance being, are you doing things right? The tasks you were given, are you executing them properly? And I think we're generally pretty good at that because that's easy to quantify and easy to measure and things like that. But measures of effectiveness is, are the things you're doing, no matter how well you're doing them, getting you closer to where you want to be? Exactly. Yeah. And that's the conversation we struggle with. And that's something that's harder to quantify and harder to measure. And I think to a certain degree, that's kind of at the root of this.
Yeah, I don't really think that it's harder to measure. You just have to be clever. You know, I was doing this work for a very large power and light company. And and they were arguing, as most people do, but all the people who work there are very mindful. And so I said, well, if it's like any other company that I've been to in this country or the world, I don't think so. So I created an aerosol can out of wood. Right. So everybody I showed it to was sure it was an aerosol can. Now that aerosol can left in certain locations would have been very, very dangerous if in fact it had been an aerosol can rather than just a piece of wood. And the question we were asking, or I was asking, was how many of these people who you're sure are mindful actually notice it? And sadly, nobody did. Right. You know, I was doing this consulting to this company, and I did the first round, and, you know, they were very happy. And then for round two, the price went up considerably, and they said, you know, sorry, we can't afford it. And of course, they could have. And then they paid me for the first round. And then 2 weeks later, they paid me again. And 3 weeks later, they paid me again, oblivious to the fact that they had done this. And all I did was bring the three checks in. And I said, you decide if you're doing things efficiently or not. You know, that's the hardest part with all of this, is because everybody thinks that they're doing as well as anybody can do. And as you might have noticed in the book, I spend a lot of time talking about language, things that I notice that most people don't. And an example is try. You know, so everybody thinks trying is good, right? And it's certainly better than not trying at all. But if I were to give you an ice cream cone, you wouldn't have to try to eat it, right? So trying has built into it an expectation for failure. All right. And so there are lots of things that, you know, where we have, where we could have been was not good, where we are is better. And then the army, industry, schools don't know that there's yet an even better place where we could be. So not trying is not good. Trying is better than not trying, but not nearly as good as just doing. Right. And I have many examples of this. When I talk to my students in a health class about limits, you know, to recognize that we never know how good anything can be. You can never prove that something can't be. Any experiment can only show you that what you tried didn't work, if it didn't work. So then I ask them a simple question. How far is it humanly possible to run? These are Harvard students. They're very smart. They know I wouldn't ask the question if the answer were 26 miles, a marathon, right? Mm-hmm. So they start. Somebody says 30. It's like an auction. 35, 40. They never go beyond 50. And then I show them a video of the Tarahumara tribe in Mexico, Copper Canyon, where they can run 250 miles without stopping. All right. So when the army arranges things saying, here's the best we can do, and we try to get to there, I think probably, you know, we can go well beyond that. As I said to you before, that mindfulness is energy begetting. We have data showing that fatigue is largely a mindset. So, for example, if we ask people, do 100 jumping jacks and tell me when you're tired, they'll get tired around 70. We take a different group of people and we say, do 200 jumping jacks. They get tired at 140. All right. You know, we can always do more than we think that we can. Unless, well, if the world is telling us you can't, you know, then we won't. And I think that a lot of what the army, as any organization, is trying to build into all of their policies and procedures, they start off with what they think the limit is. And so can we move people to that limit rather than open the whole thing up and perhaps go well beyond what they initially considered? But you're not going to get that when people are not enjoying what they're doing. You're not going to get that when people are mindlessly pursuing whatever the course is.
So I want to ask you a question.
Then ask me, Drew. If you want to ask me, ask me. That's why I'm
Stop
here.
Stop trying. Just do.
Sorry. I'll just do it. One of the things, a common theme with a number of our guests has been, how do you measure, you know, X, Y, and Z? Because having been the person sitting in the room with the senior leaders talking about specifically human performance, you can very easily measure things like, you know, scores on a PT test or time it takes to come back from an injury. And we have seen that the measurable things tend to get a lot of the resources.
I think that everything I'm talking about can be measured.
How do you measure mindfulness?
Well,
how would you put mindfulness on a PowerPoint slide?
Well, we can measure it, actually, and we have a scale, you know, but
it's named after her, I think.
Yeah, I think
no big deal.
There are 20 thoughts at once that are racing through my mind based on the little thing you threw out, thinking that, you know, just trying to make one point. Lots of the work as that I describe in the mindful body is about mind-body unity. And that means mind and body are best seen as one, in which case then wherever you put your mind, your body necessarily is. And so we can so far exceed whatever limits we presume to be real. But you had talked about, you said wounds or something. And I don't remember in what context you just said it, but it triggered for me the study that we've just done on wound healing. So this is an example of mind-body unity and the enormous control we have over our health, well-being, and virtually everything else. Mm-hmm. We inflict a wound. Now, I'm not a sadist, so we didn't really hurt people. It's not a gigantic wound, but a wound nonetheless. And we have people in front of a rigged clock. So for a third of the people, the clock is going twice as fast as real time. For a third of the people, the clock is going half as fast as real time. For a third of the people, it's real time. And what we find is that that wound heals based on clock time, perceived time, not real time. And, you know, so basically whatever we expect from people, 100 jumping jacks versus 200, how far can you run? How long can you go without being tired? And so on, are just grossly underestimated.
I just want to jump in real quick just to tie this to something the audience will understand. The study they did on wound healing time and perceived time, the wound they used was from cupping. So those of you that are big fans of cupping for muscle recovery and stuff, that's what they're referring to as a wound.
Yeah, well, you know, yes, the skin is just...
It literally is. It's a bruise.
You know, yeah. I mean, we could not cut people up. But we're doing another study now that where we take people who have different injuries, different medical conditions, and typically the case that the doctor will tell you that it's going to take, let's say, 6 months to heal. And in this study, what we're doing is having the doctor give people the fastest healing time rather than the average healing time. And we expect people will heal faster. And that's also important because if somebody is injured on, you know, while on some mission, you know, if we can get them back together, back healthy, faster, it's obviously to everybody's benefit. We also have in that same series of studies, you know, let me just tell people the very first one, which was the counterclockwise study. Mm-hmm. Now, Alex, if you've forgotten the study, all you need to do is watch The Simpsons go to Havana because they describe the study. This was the first study in mind-body unity. So we retrofitted a retreat to 20 years earlier. We had old men live there as if they were their younger selves. So everything suggested it was 20 years earlier and they would be talking about the past, but in the present tense. In a period of time as short as 1 week, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength improved, their memory improved, and they looked noticeably younger. All right, we have people who have type 2 diabetes. We give them all sorts of tests. We're going to have them play computer games. The reason will be clear. We tell them, change the game you're playing every 15 minutes or so. Next to the computer is, again, one of those rigged clocks. So for a third of the people, it's going twice as fast as real time. A third of the people half as fast, and a third of the people is real time. Blood sugar level follows perceived time. Clock time, not real time. We have people in a sleep lab wake up. The clock tells them that they got 2 hours more sleep than they think they got, 2 hours fewer, or the amount of sleep that they got. Biological and cognitive functioning follows perceived sleep. Right. So everything we think we know about a person, I think, is probably a gross underestimate of what they or we are capable of doing.
So I'll just real quickly, you basically laid out a bunch of things I had like planned on bringing up if you didn't bring them up, because I don't think we mentioned it in the invite. I've been citing your work for like 4 years now.
That's big, all?
So it's big, it's kind of exciting to have.
Well, he's
on
only six, so he hasn't been on.
Come on. In my head, I'm only six. That's why I'm so
healthy. Right?
But like just some of those examples that rattled me. You talked about perceived duration of sleep being more important than actual duration of sleep. The one you mentioned about, like, if you tell people they have good genetics for endurance or you tell people they have bad genetics for endurance, that will change their performance more than their actual genetics.
Yeah, that's my student Allie Crum did that study.
I will also shout out, I kind of want to give you a chance to go over two particular studies because they're the ones I cite the most often.
Yeah.
In the past, I've attributed both of them to you, but one was only Allie Crum. You were not actually an author.
Well, but I trained you, so I guess.
Shout out, Allie.
There you go. But the two I like, and I was about to mention that perceived level of activity influences health outcomes more than actual level of activity. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you to talk about the housekeeper study on that one. Yeah. Or the chambermaid study. And then the other one that Allie Crum did that I think is real relevant here when we get into nutrition is the mind over milkshake study, because I think that one's fascinating as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the chambermaid, which was the second study in these mind-body unity studies, all we did, well, first of all, chambermaids, as you know, are women who are working all day long. That's exercise is essentially what their work is, making beds, cleaning sinks, and so on. Oddly, they don't think they're getting any exercise because exercise, according to the Surgeon General, is what you do after work. And after work, they're just too tired. Okay. So all we did was divide a group of chambermaids into two groups, where one of them, we taught them that their work was exercise. That's all. Work making a bed is like working on this machine at the gym and so on. So now you have two groups. One group that knows their work is exercise. The other group doesn't realize this. In a period of time, I guess it was, 2 weeks, three, I don't remember how long the study was. We now take our measures. The groups are not working any harder than each other. They're not eating any differently. Nevertheless, the group that now changed their mindset now realizes that their work is exercise. They lost weight. There was a change in waist to hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came down just from changing their mind. If you believe that something is, it will play out physiologically as if it is the bottom line. And so the milkshake study, you're eating a milk, you know, drinking a milkshake is a study I think people love to be in. And you think it's high calorie or low calorie, and then your body, you know, responds accordingly. All right. That I don't think that your listeners or even you can fathom, but it took me so long to realize what all of this really means, that we haven't come close to what we can be. You know, and then we have environments where stress is sort of taken as a natural part of life. And, you know, army life, I would think, would be part of this. And mm-hmm. I think that that's also a very big mistake. You know, stress is a psychological concept. It's the belief that something is going to happen. And when it happens, it's going to be awful. And as I said, we can't predict. So you want to alleviate some of that stress. First, just come up with 5-6 reasons why it might not happen. So you went from it's definitely going to happen to maybe it will, maybe it won't. And then turn it around and let's assume it does happen. How might that be a good thing? So if we put aside battles in the army and some, you know, life and death, but everything else, and say, what is the hidden advantage in that? And so then you're in a position where this thing may or may not happen. And if it happens, it'll be fine no matter what. And stress becomes a thing of the past. For everyday people and for your army folk, when they're not on the battlefield, something also very simple that I think is effective is simply to ask yourself, is it a tragedy or an inconvenience? Mm-hmm. And almost always we're dealing with inconveniences. And we go, oh my gosh, you know, whatever. And so you take a breath, you ask yourself, does it really matter? Most of the time you're going to see that it doesn't. The soldier didn't polish his shoes correctly. I mean, you know, okay. Are we going to burn him for that?
If I'm not mistaken, and I'm probably citing your own research back to you one more time, but I think some of your findings illustrated that the perception that stress is harmful is more physiologically harmful than the actual amount of stress you experience.
Yeah, that's Allie's again, but yes, okay. Very, very important that virtually everything we experience is going to be a function of our beliefs about what the experience should be. And all of these studies that you're talking about are in the negative, but we can turn it around. And let's say with the original counterclockwise study, you know, people think that as you get old, you just sort of fall apart. You know, think about how powerful that study was. When have you ever heard a man or woman, you know, in their 80s, 90, having their hearing improve without any medical intervention, their vision? You know, so when somebody believes they can't do something, you can easily talk yourself into that. And as I said before, you can never prove that you can't do it, and you can always do more. Right? So you're doing 100 versus 200 jumping jacks. You change your expectations and everything else changes. And, you know, the image I have about fatigue, which is probably relevant to the Army more than many other things, I can see if I've imagined there's somebody who's word processing all day long, okay, and his fingers are hurting, his shoulders, and can't wait till he can leave. And then he goes home and now he plays the piano. Okay. The point is that if you change the context, you get renewed energy. There's a fun study that Frank Beach did back in the 50s. I've never heard anybody else speak of this, but I think this is a great, you'll love it. So he takes a little boy rat and a little girl rat and they copulate. Now the little boy rat needs a refractory period, right? However, if right after he's finished with the first little girl rat, you immediately introduce a second little girl rat, he's ready right away. He doesn't need that refractory period. And, you know, so I have so many studies and anecdotes and whatever showing that you change the context and everything changes. And we have to understand that context is in our heads. You know, it's not, you know, so an example that I use far afield from what you're interested in, but still, when my mother was in the hospital dealing with breast cancer, the hospital context is one that most of us has learned. And, you know, you ask permission to do things and you're kind of quiet and so on. Whereas if you're on a football field, you're yelling and screaming and standing on the benches and what have you. So that's what I mean by context. Now, when I was in the hospital with her, we had several, and there are always several contexts operating at once. So I'm in the hospital context, but I'm also in the parent-child, mother-daughter context. So in the hospital context, I'm supposed to leave at 7 o'clock. In the mother-daughter context, I'm not leaving until my mother wants me to leave. I don't care what the rule is. All right. So I think that probably would make the Army nervous to use that example. Probably not a good one. But the point of it is behavior, the way we've all been taught, our behavior tends to be context dependent. We do what seems sensible given the context. However, we can change the context and thereby change our behavior.
As you're talking about this, what comes to mind and what I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on is like, the reason I asked the question about measuring things is because the military really only focuses on things that are measurable. And for a mindfulness piece, historically, that's often meant surveys, quantifying things, personality tests.
No, I think that if we made people mindful versus mindless and we measured physical measures, we find out how fatigued they are, how long they can keep doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I can take a group of soldiers and in a very subtle way, keep changing the context for one group and not for the other, and we simply see how long they can keep performing in whatever way they've been asked to perform. I don't think measures are not hard. You just have to be a little used to generating these.
Well, do you think that there is harm in, you know, say, for example, I take whatever survey and it tells me I'm this type of person, or I'm on some sort of PowerPoint slide and I'm this percentage of 100.
Yeah, I think that's a problem.
Right, because I would assume then that the soldier or whomever would then assume, oh, that's me, that's my identity, I am this. And what you're saying is that you can change that context and actually push behavior into the direction you want it versus just saying somebody is a certain way.
Exactly. So there was a study that somebody did, I don't remember whom, but if you ask somebody questions that are there times when you don't like loud parties, so you load it, you're just priming them one way or the other, and then you have them fill out these surveys, you can make anybody introverted or extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is happy in some circumstances, confident in some circumstances, not so confident or happy in other circumstances. And the thing is that the personality dimension seems stable because we choose the circumstances we're going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people need to understand that anything that's based on science, and I'm a scientist, so, you know, science is important, but not because I'm a scientist, but I'm a scientist because it's important. We have to understand that experiments, science, only gives us probabilities, which says that if we were to do the exact same study again, which we could never do exactly the same study,
right.
If you were going to run it, Drew, the next time you do it, you're a little older. It's never exactly the same. But let's assume it was the same. The findings are likely to be the findings you got the last time. Okay, so it gives you probabilities, and then people writing textbooks, teaching courses, giving talks, translate those probabilities into absolutes. One in one is two. All of the facts that you think you know are not true some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when we give you something and it says, yeah, lots of times you are introverted, for example, that doesn't mean you aren't also at times extroverted.
Right.
Right. And you're not trapped by it. And I think there's people make a mistake in thinking that they're not able to do A, B, and C. As I said before, you can never provide evidence that you can't do it. So you try, if this doesn't work, you try it some other way. But, you know, but people seem to be different. And some of those differences that we see among us are okay, as long as we have enough respect for you, no matter where you fall on the scale.
Right.
Because most of the scales that are given have a winner and a loser.
Right.
And I think, you know, I wrote a little song for a little ditty for my grandkids when they were five. I'm not going to sing it to you because I can't carry a tune, but I should, because that's the point of it. And it's very simple. Everybody doesn't know something. Everybody knows something else. Everybody can't do something. Everyone can do something else. And so if you apply that to the army, where you have the big shot generals and you have the know nothing privates, if we really keep that frozen, that better to worse, we're giving up a lot of information. An example that I'm used to using, I was doing this lecturing in South Africa, and I was at this fancy hotel one afternoon, just taking a few hours off, and I was down by the pool. And I noticed there was a lot of real estate that the hotel owned that was simply not being used. And the only person who knew this was the lowly cabana boy. All right. You know, everybody has some information that can be important. And, you know, and this came to me in a way that we can make it relate to the army, but just the more general case, we were having a massive amount of furniture delivered that we were going to put in the basement, okay, until it was going to be used. And I said, I, the genius, there is no way that all of that can fit in that space. Now, the person who is going to put it all in that space is uneducated, thinks very little of himself, is somebody who most people would not think very highly of on many dimensions. He put it all in there so that you could access each and every piece of furniture, you know, without it being difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, I, the genius, couldn't do it. He, the non-genius, did it brilliantly. And I think when we have a rigid sense going from worse to better, that we don't take full advantage of the people on the low end of the stick, that cabana boy or this man I'm talking about, and what they can bring to the situation. And I think that the Army can be, I'm not suggesting that we rotate the privates and make them generals or, you know, what have you, but I am suggesting that what we do is realize that these people have information that we don't have. They have a viewpoint that could be relevant. You know, that if you took somebody who grew up as in an upper middle class family, trained, and you know, and the training is all based on our predictions, what we think is important. And then you take somebody who is less fortunate, and now we're going to go into some town in the middle of nowhere that's poor and what have you. I'm not sure that this other person, the person who we've diminished in some way, doesn't have more information. Mm-hmm. I had suggested something like this to NASA way back when, and it was not a group that was going to listen, but essentially we were talking about some space mission. And I said, you know, you can take your upper middle class men and train them, but you can only train them to notice the things that you know, not to know how to deal with the unknowns and the unknown unknowns. I was suggesting that maybe it would be worthwhile taking some of these kids from the ghetto who have nothing, right? The mm-hmm. world has given them nothing, who somehow can figure out how to survive. And, you know, this was, oh my gosh, this was just too far for them to go. And I'm not suggesting, you know, that the Army go there either, but I am suggesting that we, rather than think we should just be giving orders to a certain group of people, that we recognize that there may be things that they can be doing that would actually meet some of our needs, even needs we don't yet know we have, that would restore a certain respect in these people, which would have the effect of them working more meaningfully, enjoying what they're doing. With all of that mindfulness would make them healthier, which would be lower cost for the Army, and so on. Which is not an inconsequential thing, that, you know, when people are mindful, he said that they're more energized, they're going to notice solutions that other people are not going to see. And all of this, it keeps them out of hospitals. I mean, it's like a win-win-win, how many wins, solution to whatever problems we come up with, as far as I can see.
So since we're coming up close to an hour here, I do want to quickly go through a few that I think might help in terms of pointing us in the direction of practical implementation of some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
One that I pulled out, you mentioned it in Mindful Body in the context of one of the studies on training people for mindfulness, and I want to make sure that I'm interpreting it right. It talks about the main tenets of mindfulness, and I want to make sure these are like what you would recommend as far as teaching people. And it lists four of them: understanding uncertainty, importance of noticing variability, generating novelty, and recognizing that evaluations of good or bad are in our heads, not the external world. Is that what you would use for a basic framework?
Sure. Yeah. Why not? Okay. You know, I mean, you could add other things to it. It would be accepting uncertainty, exploiting the advantages to this uncertainty, to knowing that whatever we think we can do more, that everybody has something to offer, and then the four you mentioned.
So just to give an example of where this was applied, and this wasn't necessarily teaching people mindfulness, it was kind of indirectly.
This was part of our measuring mindfulness.
Yeah. So a study I want to point to in terms of a practical application that was in fact in a somewhat military setting was a study on MIT ROTC students. It comes back to the vision stuff you talked about, but like things you would not expect improving their performance on vision tests. If you put them in a flight simulator where they're like imagining themselves as pilots, and pilots have good vision, if you test them on vision afterwards, they see better.
Exactly.
And even, like you mentioned jumping jacks earlier, if you have them do a bunch of jumping jacks, athletes tend to have good vision. They're thinking of themselves as athletes. You test them on vision afterwards and they see better.
Yeah. So this started, you know, with me as a doctor and being given the Snelling eye test. And I look at this and we have a bunch of letters that make no, you know, have no meaning, and they get smaller and smaller. And I go, this is set up to lead me to expect that soon I won't be able to see. And so what we did was reverse the eye chart. So now the letters got larger and larger, thereby changing the expectation that soon I will be able to see. And when you did that, people were able to see things they couldn't see before. Along those same lines, most people can see about two-thirds of the way down the eye chart. So we started the chart a third of the way down. So now two-thirds of the way down, we're going to be much smaller letters. And again, people could see what they couldn't see before. I think the important part that's relevant to vision and what you were asking me before is to recognize that everything is in motion. And when we take measures, we tend to hold things still. So even if we're talking about vision, you know, you go to the doctor's office, you're looking at letters that have no meaning out of any context, and then you're told this is how well you see. I don't know about you, but if I'm hungry, I can see the restaurant sign, you know, very far away. Things that are moving, you can see differently from things that are still, things that are in color, so on and so forth. But more important is that when we're able to see will also vary. And so if you didn't put on those glasses immediately and instead were, you know, just seeing what you could see and then noticing when you're having trouble seeing and, you know, and then ask why. Well, so let's say you're an early riser and you start having trouble seeing around 2 p.m. Perhaps it's because you're tired, in which case take a nap or have an energy bar. But by putting on the glasses, we're training ourselves to need the glasses. And remember that with elderly men, we were able to get their vision to improve. So things improve when we recognize sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. And we say, well, why now? Is it better or is it worse? And then we can take advantage of that information. And that's essentially the attention to symptom variability technique that we use to help cure chronic illnesses. We've done it with Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, chronic pain, depression, stroke, arthritis, big things, right? And by getting people to notice when it's a little better, when it's a little worse, and ask the question why, three things happen. The first, by saying that it varies, oh, wow, and, you know, I'm not in great pain, for instance, all the time. Second, by asking why now, is it better or worse than before? That initiates a mindful search. And that mindfulness, as we've said now many times, itself is good for your health. And third, when you're looking for a solution, you're more likely to find one than if you're not looking.
I have one final kind of practical application question. It's a little less practical than the previous two, but I was really interested in the...
As if anybody remembers what the previous two were. Yeah.
I was going to say, selling himself short.
I was really interested in the something in the air study direction, the mindfulness contagion stuff.
Yeah, so this is wild.
Can I just pause and say, your studies have the coolest names.
Yeah.
They all sound like Disney movies.
A lot of these are her students, so she must be training them well. The idea before we go into it, just to like lay it out for people, is that like the simplest one I found was if you go into a room where there have recently been people in that room practicing mindfulness, it changes not only your perception, but also your performance. Right. You will perceive the room as more welcoming and you will perform better on reaction time tests. Yeah. Nothing is different about the room, just that somebody was in there before you being mindful. And when it was done with somebody else in the room not being mindful, the benefits were not there.
Okay. So I don't need to describe it. You described it perfectly. But let me say that I had a chapter in this book that initially I called the woo-woo chapter. And it was stuff that, you know, really interesting. The data seemed to suggest this, but it's so far out, who knows? And I got rid of 3/4 of that. The in-the-air study stayed. And we're, you know, we're replicating it actually next month. There's something, you know, many people who travel in the past, at least when I was your age, and you'd go to Europe and you never went to churches, you know, in your hometown. But there are so many cathedrals that are impressive and important. And you walk into one and it just feels different. Now, the architecture is different. There's probably lots of reasons, but this in the air study came from that, that there is some way, and we have lots of data, studies that are, our mindfulness is contagious. Now, just think about it, even in the simplest way. When you're mindful, people know that you're present. When you're mindful, you're not judgmental, and people can feel that. And so when you're talking to somebody who seems to be accepting, you know, accepting you, that's going to allow you to be more mindful. And we have studies where, you know, some of the reasons that people drink a lot is to, because so many people are mindless and it's so discomforting that, you know, let me take a drink so I'll feel better, that when they're with people who are mindful, they drink less. People who are autistic perform better. And then you have the strange effects of the in the air. And one that's even more wild, that again, we need to replicate, but just so people see the extent of my insanity, we have, you'll be standing next to somebody, no eye contact, and that person is mindful or mindless. And we give you something to read that has a double word in it. And when the person next to you is mindful, you see that double word. Otherwise, you don't. And people don't realize how much they're not seeing because of their mindless predictions. So a famous study that Simon and Chabris did, where they have people watching a basketball game. In the middle of, and this is unbelievable.
Yep, classic.
In the middle of the basketball game, right, somebody dressed in a gorilla suit comes on the court. People do not see it. And it's hard to imagine not seeing. Right. And if you just think of how much we're not seeing, we're not hearing, we're not feeling, and we're oblivious to all of it. That's why I say that by reading, you know, reading this book and just getting a sense, my goodness, one study after the other, and then let your mind, you know, go to places thinking, well, what if this, what if that? The worlds that we could be experiencing could be so different from the world we're experiencing now, where most people are stressed, so many people are depressed, people are committing suicide who have a potential for a long life before them. People are dealing with the world as if it's zero sum. If you win, that means I have to lose. All of these things that wouldn't be part of a mindful world.
Mm-hmm. So I said that I was asking that because it's practical, and despite the woo-woo-ness of it, I think there's some practicality.
Oh,
that,
no, no. You know, that... the woo-woo-ness is, I believe the studies, which is why I did them and why I write about them. All I'm saying is those are, you know, probably a little harder for the, you know, for some people to believe than some of the other
haters.
Yeah, eventually all of this will be known and be, you know, sort of second nature, whatever that means to a lot.
Exactly. I think it implies a tipping point where, as we like start getting more people on board with some of these concepts, at a certain point, when you're surrounded by people who are on board with these things and exposed to more of it, it becomes easier to incorporate it in how you approach the world. That's all.
Good.
Well, I wanna be mindful of your time, but I also have a question I want to ask you.
You know, you both keep saying that, you know, it's very clever that you're watching my time. And the last time Alex said, I'm watching your time, but I have four more questions for you. But go on, Drew. I'm happy. Give me your best shot.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about something I've referred to quite a bit. And I think it was, I'm sure other folks have done this, but Elon Musk is always the one who's referenced. And it's this idea of first principles versus analogies. And when you think through analogies, or when you think analogously, it's mindless things that allow you to sort of quote unquote, save like cognitive bandwidth or whatever. And what I'm envisioning is like reaching for the coffee mug or pouring the cereal. These aren't things we do mindlessly. But so would you think that in cases like that, there's a place for mindlessness?
No, that's what I said before. Mindlessness is never to our advantage. If you're going to do it, you should show up for it. And mindfulness is energy begetting, not consuming. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to save your bandwidth.
Fair enough. So now, being mindful of your time, I'm going to ask you one last question.
You're going to ask me one last question, and then Alex is going to ask me three last questions.
This is the actual closer.
This is a closer. And I wrote this out, and I'm very proud of how I phrased this, so I hope that you find it to be entertaining. But being mindful of mindfulness, what is something you have changed your mind about in the last, say, 5 years?
Well,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, it was more than 5 years ago, but I did my dissertation on what I called the illusion of control. And that actually was a paper that became very important in the beginning to create behavioral economics. And the illusion of control study found that people were doing all these bizarre things that suggested that they didn't understand probability. You know, it'd be, although I didn't study this one, but it'd be like talking to the slot machine and thinking that that's going to, come on, baby, you know, that that's going to change the likelihood of winning. And then I realized that it's a mistake to call it an illusion, that from the perspective of the person who's doing what I initially saw as bizarre, they believe that they have control. And then we can never know, you know, whether somebody has control over something or not. There are many things where we say there's no way it can be done until somebody does the impossible, and then we recognize that it's possible. So that was probably an important change for me. Realizing, as I've already told you now, also more than 4 years ago, but that every time we're being judgmental of ourselves or somebody else, we're being mindless. You know, that presuming that there's only one way of seeing that behavior and God, are you an idiot for doing it, rather than realizing there was some good reason from your perspective. People say to me all the time with some of these studies, what did I expect to happen? And I expect it to have a positive effect or else I wouldn't do the study in the first place. You know, that the first study where we gave people choices, elderly people, mindful choices to make, and then we found out that they live longer. Well, why would I measure how long they live if some part of me didn't think that it's going to result in longer life? That doesn't mean that when you get the effect, that's a big one like that, that you're not, oh, wow, you know, you realize you were hoping, you thought, but, you know, now you have confirmation for it. I forgot your question, but why don't you shape your question to my answer?
Perfect. No, just asking what you've changed your mind about. And I think you nailed that on a number of different occasions.
Yeah, no, I think people often have the wrong, at least for the way I practice science, the wrong understanding of it. For me, I see something. I see myself responding, let's say, in a way that's different from other people. And then I start questioning why, you know, and then I do the study. So I've already seen it to be true, you know, and then I set up the study essentially to see if it's widely true or, you know, was it a fluke, more or less. So I'm not going to be surprised quite as often. You know, that for the original study that for this mind-body work that I mentioned now, it's very nice when you have something like the ultimate dependent measure. You know, people are alive or dead at the end of this. And, you know, so people could argue with me that my explanation for it might be different from what they would think their explanation for it. But by and large, my greatest goal is to show that it's possible. And I think that all of my work can be understood as pursuing the psychology of possibility.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end it. So Dr. Langer, thank you very much for your time. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm going to go through the rest of my day paying a lot more attention to a lot more things.
Good. Okay. Well, I've enjoyed it. And thank both of you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter in, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.